Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Welcome to KQED's Youth Takeover Week. We'll have three forum shows this week produced by Bay Area high school students. And up first, we're going to look at digital political campaigning. All the way back to 2004 and Howard Dean, politicians have tried to organize online. But in the 20-teens, digital advertising became a massively important part of every campaign. The digital world moves quickly, and the platforms and tactics that made sense in 2016 or 2020 have changed. We'll get you up to date with our young colleagues and a panel of political media experts. That's all coming up next, right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is always an exciting week here at the station where we get to work alongside students from across the Bay Area. They've been putting together shows for weeks and weeks along with our staff, and this first show starts with simple curiosity. What are all these politicians doing on social media, and why, and how does it change depending on the platform and audience? This show is conceptualized by our first two guests, two members of KQED's Youth Advisory Board. We've got Ryan Heshmati, a junior at Saratoga High School. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
And we've also got Kate Quach, a junior at St. Ignatius High School. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. Excited to be here as well.
So, Kate, let's start with you. What's your interest in this world of kind of politics and social media?
Definitely. I'd say I've been more involved with politics on social media. I mean, I see them on my feed. I'm scrolling through those videos. And so I definitely do get influenced oftentimes by those campaigns. I think back to, you know, the 2020 election and that campaign where everyone was remote. So social media was the way to connect. Sitting in my eighth grade class in between lunch breaks and just trying to catch this Twitch stream with AOC on it. She invited all these popular gamers over to her stream, and I thought that was so creative as a way to leverage the modern times, but to also influence political campaigns as well. And I found that while she was talking, you know, instead of in between playing the game, she was talking about immigration and environmental causes, and I found myself learning so much from that, even though it was just a simple interaction with in a lobby of gamers.
Yeah. And what are your platforms, or where are you online?
Yeah, so I am on Instagram and TikTok. So a lot of those posts and videos that come on my feed, I sometimes click into them and scroll around. So definitely active on those.
Yeah. And Ryan, how about you? I mean, I know that you're less of a social media person than Kate, but your interest in politics is very strong.
In fourth grade, we had a project. Our teachers made us learn about all the propositions on the ballot, and we were asked to find one and advocate. So we went down to the little city plaza, and we advocated our yes or no. And that was where I sort of started that interest, I went to my first political rally in fourth grade. And from there, I kept that going. And I love that program from CNN, Race to the White House, where they talked about all these past elections. So that was one super fun way. And then I also read a lot of news on politics.
And are you like a, what are your news sources? Are you like a legacy media? Are you, where are you online?
To me, Apple News Plus has been like a huge blessing because I can compile all the areas I want to be reading. I read Wall Street Journal, KQED, NPR, and CNN because I want that breadth.
I mean, Kate, sounds like you've had some important experiences in online spaces that have helped you think about it. Do you have any worries about the social media realm?
Oh, gosh, definitely. I mean, everything is such in a short, bite-sized format that I worry sometimes, am I getting the correct information? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, I have another tab open to a search bar saying, wait, is this actually true? So I have to juggle back and forth between, you know, consuming media in a quick, easy way and actually trying to cross-reference and cross-check with, you know, other reliable media sources.
Totally. I mean, Ryan, with your approach to news, there's so much that happens, say, you know, on X, formerly Twitter, or in TikTok, or these different places that are kind of contained inside that platform. Do you worry that you're kind of like missing out on what might be happening with like political campaigning on Snapchat?
You know, absolutely. I think that one of the things that's been concerning for me is I don't get information as fast, that leads to a little bit of a lapse. But what I've found is at least I can rely upon it. Some of my friends, when you're getting so many short form videos one after another, you might get a lot of information, but then not all of it may be true. Some of it might be misleading. And in that sense, I feel like I make up for not getting the information an hour earlier.
Right, because you can fill in the context with what you're getting from the reputable sources that you're reading in other ways. Kate, how about among your peers? I mean, do you find like you're an outlier in the sense that you would like to see AOC in the Twitch lobby versus like somebody else who's like, I'm trying to play Call of Duty here or whatever?
I think it's a pretty broad spectrum, and I feel like a lot of people actually align with me in wanting to see more political media in social media. There was a record number of viewers in that stream, I remember, and it broke a lot of trends at that time. So I feel like there's this collective want to see more, you know, social justice and advocacy media intertwined with what we see on our day-to-day feed.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about the elections and how social media has changed political messaging with KQED's Youth Advisory Board. We are joined by the two students who conceptualize and produce this show, Kate Quach, a junior at St. Ignatius High School, and Ryan Hashmati, a junior at Saratoga High. So even in your time, just in high school, have you noticed any changes in kind of the platforms that people are using?
I think it really branched off into TikTok. TikTok really exploded during the high school years just because of how convenient it was. People could share with the click of a button. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think social media differs so much from TV because if you watch TV on the news, you're consciously clicking onto one channel only. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I'm on the feed, I can see one video from, you know, a left-wing perspective, two videos down, one from a right-wing perspective. So I think I'm consuming both of that media at the same time. And, you know, just with the convenience of TikTok, that's where it really comes in and pleases people.
Ryan, I'm curious, have you seen in the wild, like a television political ad?
Yeah, when I was watching Race to the White House, actually, they talked about the Dukakis attack ad about Willie Horton in 1988, and that one was very impactful for me.
Mm-hmm. How come?
It's so different from what we have today. This ad, and I did a little bit of research after to learn the context, was used to create a narrative, and that was one of, oh, there's disarray, there will be crime, and those are narratives that stick on today if Dukakis is elected. But for instance, it's referred to as the Willie Horton ad, but in fact, Mr. Horton never went by the term or the name Willie. That was imposed upon him to fit that narrative. And that I think that actually was part of the reason we wanted to do this show, to see, well, that was 1988. Where are we now?
I mean, I think one thing that people do say is that it's easier to target messages more precisely. Do you feel that targeting yourself? Like, for example, like if you saw a Joe Biden post on TikTok and it's done in kind of the style of other TikTok posts, do you feel like, ah, this political candidate is speaking to me? Or do you feel like, all right, you know, this is pandering to me instead?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think politicians on TikTok are trying to make this a relatable format, easy for young audiences. And I do think it affects me in some way, trying to see, oh, they're with the times, or, you know, some social media manager is actually keeping up and wants to share this message with the right audience. You know, also during the 2020 campaign, there was this collective group called Gen Z for Change, where all these popular young creators on TikTok came together to advocate for voting and the Biden administration as well. So just to see that happen was so inspiring for me, because, I mean, we've seen social media as mainly a platform for entertainment, and seeing how youth want to get involved in serious topics like politics was really, you know, impactful for where I was at that time.
Yeah. You know, one of our listeners, Scott, writes in to say, thanks for sharing youth voices. How much of Congress's attacks on social media platforms is, quote, old people just not getting it? And how much of it is legit in your view?
For me, I'm actually very concerned about social media myself, and I was glad to hear that Congress is concerned too, because specifically with TikTok, I think the national concern or security concerns are founded in real reasoning. And as such, I feel it's reasonable to put a spotlight on TikTok. There were 9 billion videos posted in 2020 on this platform. This is where our generation is going to, and I think shining a lens on that is valuable.
Yeah. What do you think, Kate?
I know, yeah, I saw that news about the TikTok ban from the House as well. And on CNN, I read how there's an 80% chance with the Senate of also following that same route. And I think it will definitely, you know, hurt some people who have small businesses on the app, or that's their main source of income. I worry about that. But also, you know, misinformation and national security can also get out of hand.
Yeah. Do you worry among your peers that youth voter disengagement, as Steve writes on Discord, you know, is a big issue, that like young people, you know, a little bit older than you, both 17, so you can't vote quite yet, but, you know, the seniors at your high school, are you worried that they're not going to go to the polls just because they have become totally disengaged?
I think I'm a little bit worried about, you know, them not using their right to vote, because we are the rising generation of leaders and policymakers, and I think we should stand up and go to the polls, however possible. You know, even though TikTok or social media might not be available during that time, we should still remember, you know, this is for the right thing, this is for the right cause.
I wanted to ask you, Alexis, you have young children. How are you feeling about their viewing of political messaging on social media?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I mean, my kids are 8 and 10, so they're a lot younger than you. And I think mostly what they get is stuff that's kind of coming in by osmosis. You know, their friends who are allowed to watch YouTube freely sometimes come up with these different things. And we end up, you know, explaining to kids the context around what it is they may have heard about, you know, lizard people, or, you know, conflicts across the world, or whatever. You know, it's all kind of a mix. And I think one of the things that most concerns me, though I'm glad that their friends are learning about the world, is that things are kind of out of order, and there isn't like an actual narrative that they can sort of understand about how the world has changed and developed through time. And I think that is really complicated, right? It's just this kind of smattering of information rather than you know, what historians have put together or other folks. We're talking about elections and how social media has changed political messaging with KQED's Youth Advisory Board. We're joined by Ryan Heshmati, a junior at Saratoga High School, and Kate Quach, a junior at St. Ignatius, who produced this show. We're going to be back with some political experts after the break. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about elections and how social media has changed political messaging. This show is produced by high school students Ryan Heshmati and Kate Quach as part of KQED's Youth Takeover Week, and they built out an amazing panel for us. I want to bring in McKenna Kelly, senior politics writer and author of Wired's new Politics Lab newsletter, just launched. Thanks for joining us, McKenna.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah. Also want to bring in Kyle Tharp. His newsletter is For What It's Worth. He tracks digital strategy, spending, and trends in politics.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
We've also got David Brockman, associate professor of political science at UC Berkeley, who studies, you know, voter persuasion, political messaging, et cetera. Thanks for joining us, David.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, Kyle, I want to come to you first. I mean, you launched your For What It's Worth newsletter back in 2018 to track how political campaigns use the internet to get their messages out. I mean, how have you seen the space change just, you know, over that last 6 years?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been crazy kind of watching how the social media ecosystem has evolved over the past few years. I mean, I think the internet this year is less trackable than ever. You know, back then, you know, before the 2020 election, Instagram didn't really even have its Reels feature. TikTok was not widely used like it is today. Campaigns were just starting to invest in heavy spending and digital advertising, like on platforms like Facebook and Google. And so, yeah, I mean, it feels like there's been just a massive acceleration in different types of online outreach since then.
And also a spread, like already, I think people had liked to talk about media fragmentation and fragmentation of messaging, you know, in 2016. And now what you're describing is, you know, this fractal continuation of that trend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the one thing that we'll probably talk a lot about today is TikTok and how that's changed. But another major trend is just Facebook, which used to be the massive sort of elephant in the room, has really pulled back from politics over the years and started deprioritizing political content. And there's major ramifications for how campaigns and political actors use those platforms.
Yeah. You know, I mean, my other question too, is you said that the political messaging world has become less trackable. It's you know, the least trackable that it's been. Is that because part of that pullback from Facebook too, or part of the tools that researchers were able to use to understand what was going on have actually become less effective over time?
Absolutely. Well, after, you know, the 2016 elections, a lot of these big tech companies really leaned into politics, put in a bunch of safeguards to monitor misinformation, created tools, one of which was called CrowdTangle, which was acquired by Facebook, mm-hmm. which allowed you to track viral engagement and posts on the platforms. Since 2020, those big tech companies realized that politics is kind of a headache for their PR teams. And so a lot of them really pulled back on those investments. And so now, you know, we have less insight into how information is spreading online. TikTok is an incredibly opaque platform in that regard. Twitter is now a little bit more, or X is a little bit more chaotic than ever. People are getting their news from different sources. There's a rise of partisan media companies. And so it's just this crazy environment, kind of like the Wild West.
Or like hyper partisan media companies, you know? Yeah. We'd love to hear from you. I mean, how do you engage with politicians online? Like, do you think that political campaigns should be campaigning across this wide variety of social media? Or maybe you've seen a political ad of some kind that's convinced you or turned you away from a candidate or issue. I'd love to hear from you. The email address, of course, is forum@kqed.org. You can find us on any of our social channels, or you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. McKenna, so given this fragmentation, given the opaque nature or even more opaque nature of the newer platforms, how are you going about doing your job of you know, being Wired's kind of a political newsletter writer?
Right. I mean, the whole thing from 2020 has changed so much, where I was able to track things mostly on Twitter, because a lot of ads, a lot of outreach was done over that platform. And now, like, the President Biden will do some TikTok at the White House with someone making a video about, like, his first date with Jill Biden or something. And I don't even find it. I'll find it weeks later because it shows up on my For You page. There isn't a place that is, like, you know, one big news feed, right, where I can find anything anymore. And so it's really trying to find people who are part of different communities of people who would be specific outreach points for these campaigns. So who are really popular young people on TikTok? Well, I got to go talk to them. You know, who are like environmental activists who people would talk to online? For example, RFK Jr., one of his big TikToks that he did recently was with an environmental activist who, like, does a lot of shark research or something in Hawaii. And of course, I don't find that. You know, it's not marked anywhere. It's not locked in some database. So you really just, it's more predictive, really, than it is, you know, just having it fed to you.
You know, there's also just this explosion of political and politics adjacent content, I want to say, in the podcasting world, which of course is also enormous and opaque. How have you been tracking that?
Oh my goodness. Well, good example. The other week, Biden had that big fundraiser with $25 million for the campaign with Obama and Bill Clinton. And before they did that event, they were on the Smartlist podcast, which is, you know, a bunch of the Arrested Development people. And had the campaign not posted that, I probably wouldn't have found it because I don't listen to that podcast.
Right.
And so it's hard. It's very difficult to track these things. And it's difficult to, you know, just kind of understand what they're even trying to do with this, because a lot of the problems that we have right now is that a lot of these aren't technically labeled as ads. They're
right.
not logged in any way. It kind of just seems like this very nice conversation held between two people. But when you look at the Smartlist podcast, when you look at other podcasts that these candidates are going on, they're asking them pretty softball questions, not the kind of questions that you would get from journalists, hopefully like myself, I hope, but other journalists as well, right? Where they would ask maybe more harder questions than a lot of these influencers, creators, and actors do.
So same question for both of you, but first, Kyle, let's go to you. You know, there's one point of view that might just say, well, things have changed, but basically, if there's no advantage to either party or to any part of the, you know, ideological spectrum or box chart or however you want to think about it, then it doesn't really matter, right? Like, if this is just another realm of human activity that is being, you know, kind of cut in on with political advertising, it doesn't really matter. Do you think that a political party or a particular stance has an advantage in this overall world?
You know, it's incredibly difficult to say. Voters get information from so many different places. What's really interesting is monitoring how each side uses different platforms to reach different voters, right? So I think TikTok is a lot more important currently for a lot of Democratic campaigns, progressive organizations, than it is for Republicans. And so they're engaging there a lot more. Trump and his campaign have engaged a lot with the UFC community, you know, creating viral content of him appearing at UFC fights to reach this kind of hyper-masculine audience that that may be more likely to support him. So I think you mentioned Joe Biden on podcasts. You know, their team really recognizes reaching people on all sorts of different lifestyle platforms, like Jay Shetty's podcast or Anderson Cooper's. So yeah, it's really interesting. I definitely can't like decide which way it benefits.
Yeah. David Brockman, I want to bring you in here, political scientist at Berkeley. You know, we're talking a lot about political messaging in the digital realm. But of course, a lot of political ad spending, a lot of the effort of messaging still goes to kind of traditional media platforms, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at the lion's share of spending is still going to TV. TV is still king. With that said, I mean, obviously, spending on digital platforms is going way up. And, you know, I think just to echo, I think, a theme that has echoed through, you know, some of the comments of the other guests, that what we know about the effects of political spending, which we frankly know more about TV than digital for all the reasons that have been said, it's hard to study, it's hard to track, it's getting harder, is that the effects are small, but they're there and they add up. And so when I hear these stories about, you know, the Joe Biden campaign going on a, you know, a random podcast that, you know, some, you know, small number of people listen to, you know, I think, you know, that's just an example of, you know, just like the effect of, you know, one or two TV ads where no one thing is going to win the election. But when you add up all of this together, it does make a big difference.
Yeah. McKenna, one of the things that I've been really curious about is the kind of role of the influencer world in all this. Like if we take corporate entities to know what they're doing, that's where a lot of their money has gone now, right? They are, of course, buying traditional ads on Instagram. They're buying traditional TV ads. But a lot of their effort is going to using influencers as part of their effort.
Sure. So a lot of influencer marketing and politics has become a mainstay by 2024. There's a lot of experimentation in 2020, like when the Biden campaign started building its own kind of influencer network, started building real relationships with these people. But the role of the influencer is really interesting. And I think it's one that we haven't discussed enough yet, because there is this kind of give and take relationship with influencers and a politician, right? That maybe that exists, of course, in the journalism world, but there is this wanting to please a client type thing. There is, you know, you also have people who aren't like trained on journalism and things like that. And so they're able to get things wrong. I remember a couple of weeks ago, I was looking up on Threads and there was a bunch of people who I knew were at the White House the week before as digital influencers. And they were spreading this breaking news that did not happen about the Israel-Hamas conflict. And then I followed up with them and I was like, hey, what's all this about? Where did you get this news? Because like I myself couldn't find it in the New York Times or the AP or anything like that. And they ended up like, oh, I'm going to take this down. It's wrong. So, you know, these people just aren't being checked in the same way that my editor checks my work, right? And it allows this kind of, but those posts, I think it's important to note that those posts were going viral. Mm-hmm. They were getting a lot of retweets, they were getting a lot of likes. Mm-hmm. And then what do? You know, after all that information's out, you apologize, but these people already saw it. So
yeah,
it's really difficult.
It's such a good point. I mean, it just points out, you know, journalism is really like a set of tools for vetting information. Mm-hmm. It's not just a profession. And you know, influencers, that's not their training or the tool set that they're really bringing to things. Let's bring in some callers here. Let's go to Phil in Burlingame. Welcome, Phil.
Hi. So, I've been trying to monitor social, you know, media for political messages, and the thing that needs to be talked about is the idea of bots and, you know, outside governmental influencers. So, for example, we know that Russia has been, you know, employing bot teams in other countries, and they're really prevalent, and they're very apparent when you go through, because you'll say some comment to them and they don't come back with, you know, they fail the Turing test. They don't come back with like an intelligent answer. And meanwhile, Facebook has no mechanism to report them or remove them. And, you know, it's known, right? I mean, the first impeachment trial was about Russian influence. And yet we all seem to be turning a blind eye to it.
Mm. You know, it's a really good point. I think I'm going to come to you, McKenna, on this first. I mean, I'm of two minds of this. I'm going to come to you on this after this, David, on a different point. I'm of two minds on this. One is it's pretty clear that other countries are making small investments in these kinds of like disinformation campaigns, running bot farms, you know, creating little AI personas that are supposed to be doing things. And, you know, lots of evidence came out about this after the 2016 election. McKenna, I think the big question is, do those things make a difference? Right. I mean, that seems to be one of the biggest questions that we haven't really been able to solve.
Sure. So the interesting thing about Russian disinformation campaigns that I always try to bring up is that they aren't just creating false narratives. They are amplifying divisions in U.S. political culture across the two parties to make things worse. So these are issues that already exist in our culture, mm-hmm. that they're using these internet platforms to amplify. And I fear with the rise in the commercialization of AI-generated images and software, that we're already seeing some bizarre stuff online. 404 Media had this really great, hilarious, and sad story about images of like a crustacean Jesus going viral on Facebook, and all of the comments were like amen of other bots. And so the internet is becoming like totally unmanageable at this point. Oh, and I fear like with this kind of, you know, AI generated software, regardless of how people are getting it, it's going to be such a big issue this year, and we're just started.
So David, but my question for you around this is that one of your areas of expertise is essentially like the failure of political messaging. You know that most of the time, kind of regardless of platform or candidate or issue, that people trying to kind of aim the pitch and get it where they want it to go and persuade voters totally fail. So if our own experts in politics who know American culture really well can't really succeed at persuading voters, how likely do we think outside influencers from other nations are likely to be able to do it?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, I think the first blush take on these bot operations, or similarly what AI generated fake content might create, is the thought that okay, well, this is going to sort of hypnotize everybody and have these big impacts on public opinion. And the fact is, for a variety of reasons, public opinion is just really hard to influence. I don't want to say the effects are zero, right? Just like the effects of TV ads and campaigns are not zero. Right. There can be small effects. Those can matter in a really, really close election like we sometimes have. But I worry more about something else, which is, for example, take the case of fake AI generated content. I think people are smart enough that, let's say, the internet is filled with fake videos of Joe Biden, fake videos of Donald Trump. I think people would quickly adjust to realize, okay, like I can't trust the videos I see of Biden and Trump on the internet because they might be made up. And that itself is actually the thing I worry about more. That in a world in which, it's really important, like the, media, like KQED, all the media sources play a really important role in helping citizens hold politicians accountable. And I worry that we get to a world like we see in some other countries where people don't trust the media because, they hear one media source says something's true, like a politician is engaging in some corruption or something. Another media source says it isn't true. And as a voter, you're just left, it's not that you're manipulated, it's that you don't know what to believe. And that's a great world for a corrupt politician, a politician that wants to do, go abrogate, voters' wishes, because they can say, oh, it's all lies. Don't trust what you read.
Yeah, Kyle, do you see signs of that essentially everything getting turned into this like content slurry, regardless of political party or who's generating or anything like that, just makes it harder for any message to come through about any candidate or issue?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's all within the context of the platforms. And so, the fact that Facebook, Instagram, and Threads are sort of deprioritizing politics makes a lot of folks not see political content as much anymore. Instagram is making folks explicitly opt in to seeing political content from accounts that they don't follow. And so that's going to have a huge impact this year. Mm-hmm. I think on the previous point, it's just really interesting. Like, I think that will have like a massive effect, particularly when it comes to sort of thinking through safeguards that the platforms are enforcing. When it comes to AI generated content, we've already seen examples where Meta is not able to prevent people from sharing content or enforce their policies. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of worries that a lot of these policies that these companies are rolling out will not be enforced on election.
We're talking about election, social media, digital technology. This show was produced by KQED's Youth Advisory Board members Ryan Heshmati, a junior at Saratoga High School, and Kate Quach, a junior at St. Ignatius. They joined us earlier in the show as well. Right now, we've got David Brockman, an associate professor of political science at UC Berkeley. Kyle Tharp, who you just heard, his newsletter is For What It's Worth and tracks digital strategy spending and trends in politics. We're also joined by McKenna Kelly, senior politics writer and author of Wired's Politics Lab newsletter. We'd love to hear from you. I mean, what have you seen of political campaigns on social media? You can email us forum@kqed.org or ask any questions for our experts here about how digital campaigning is going. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about elections and how social media has changed political messaging. We're joined by McKenna Kelly, senior politics writer and author of Wired's Politics Lab newsletter. Kyle Tharp runs the newsletter For What It's Worth and tracks digital strategy, spending, and trends in politics. And we've got David Brockman, an associate professor of political science at UC Berkeley, who studies political messaging. This show was produced by members of KQED's Youth Advisory Board. This is Youth Takeover Week here at the station. Ryan Heshmadi, a junior at Saratoga High School, and Kate Quach, a junior at St. Ignatius, produced this show. Love to hear from you about your questions that you have about how the digital campaign has changed, you know, from, of course, the 2016 election in which this came to the fore for lots of people. And now the number is 866-733-6786. And the email is forum@kqed.org. Let's bring in Matt in Oakland. Welcome, Matt.
Hi. I was going back to the influencer situation and that. Oftentimes, those are purely transactional, even if it's something that does not necessarily align with their personal and political values, kind of it's for sale. And one of the other challenges is that, you know, I think that oftentimes, you know, the right has been very, very good at using, as we now see this with state actors as well, that, you know, sowing that kind of confusion, that's, you know, creating chaos within that so that truth is difficult to discern. You know, these are kinds of things that state actors have been doing. This is disinformation. This is not necessarily...
Right.
Political campaigning, you know, and I think that that's a distinction that deserves to be made. You know, there's also a book by George Lakoff, mm-hmm. the Berkeley linguist, called Don't Think of an Elephant, that kind of also outlines how, you know, the American conservative movement has kind of really been very good at taking over the language and kind of directing the message and reframing the debate. And I think that that you know, yeah. that has also been taken up on a more international basis, mm-hmm. Using those same tactics. You know, oftentimes you see this in advertising or with situations like the tobacco industry or the petroleum companies, you know, kind of creating enough inability to discern the truth or continually creating questions that, that you know, ordinary folks just kind of tune out.
Right, like that book, Merchants of Doubt, for example. Yeah, Matt, these are really good questions. Let me turn to David Brockman on this, in part because I think your work, as I read it, casts some doubt on the ability of what would be called in your field political elites to actually persuade people to believe things that they don't already believe.
Yeah, I think it's worth, you know, I don't want to sound Pollyannish as if, you know, this stuff doesn't matter at all. But I do think it's worth bearing in mind just the number of challenges that a political elite, let's say, so, you know, a politician, someone working with an influencer has to overcome to persuade people. So the first thing, which I think is sometimes overlooked, is people have to actually literally receive and hear the message, right? And so just the... people nowadays have more choice than ever in what media they want to consume. The kinds of people who are, you know, politically persuadable, who don't follow politics that much, who are generally select out of consuming a lot of political media. So, you know, when we see, you know, a Fox News interview or a CNN interview, that's largely being watched by the kind of people who are political junkies. So that's, you know, a first challenge. Second challenge is people. kind of have their own thoughts about politics and their own people that they trust. So even if they hear some message, the average person maybe in the moment might say, okay, that's interesting, but generally is not going to care enough or trust it enough to really decide to change their beliefs. And so what you generally find in response to a variety of political events, political messages, is no or maybe a small kind of temporary bump followed by a return to a pre-existing baseline. You know, you could think about, sometimes we have these like really titanic events in politics, right? So think about, you know, when I was young, 9/11 happened. And, you know, you just look at the graph of George W. Bush's approval, and there's this huge increase. And then, you know, over the course of a few years, it kind of goes back. And by the time you look at the 2006 elections, like, he's not so popular anymore. And, you know, that was a, you know, a nuclear bomb of an event, right? And a lot of these other events that we think of as like big game changers in politics, most people are not going to hear about. And the ones that do, maybe in the moment, they kind of think, oh, you know, that's annoying. Or, but then a few days later, they forget.
Yeah. You know, one thing we know can and has affected U.S. presidential elections are our third-party candidates. And McKenna, I wanted to come to you. You've written about the RFK Jr. campaign and its kind of extremely online nature. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what you're seeing that campaign do that maybe, you know, the major party campaigns are not?
Sure. So a big thing when RFK Jr. launched his campaign, it was like a year ago last week, actually, that he joined the race. And over the first couple of weeks of his campaign, he was calling this election the podcast election. he immediately went on Joe Rogan's podcast, where he was allowed to talk, you know, for 2.5 hours, you know, without really being checked or corrected in any way. And this has just become like a trend in his campaign. He is, you know, cavorting with all kinds of podcasters, people who have huge audiences that aren't technically political. You know, similar to a lot of what the Biden campaign is doing, like Theo Vaughn, the comedian, Rob Schneider. There is this huge, like, celebrity effect around RFK Jr., partially because of his wife, Cheryl Hines, being involved in Hollywood, and then also just the Kennedy name. Like, the Kennedys are a very popular family. They are just American royalty. And so a lot of what his campaign is doing, he's the most followed politician on presidential candidate on TikTok. He is constantly going viral. And recently, until today, actually, there was a creator named Link Lauren who was on RFK Jr.'s campaign. They started collaborating on content last year. And by March of this year, even just by doing these collaborations, posting interviews and all this, softball questions, of course, he was invited as a senior advisor on the campaign. And he left today, but over the last couple of months, he has been working, you know, so directly with content creators to speak at lengths. And I think that's the really important thing about RFK Jr. is that he will go on TV, but where he flourishes the most is where he can talk for hours in a way that almost hypnotizes you, right? In a way that almost hypnotizes you into thinking you're having this really polite conversation with this person who makes a lot of sense, when really he's trafficking in a lot of wild conspiracy theories.
This is interesting to reckon, because it's kind of different from trying to persuade someone over a single issue, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I decided after a long time that I needed to watch an RFK advertisement so I could understand, like, kind of what was happening there. Because it did seem like it built from nothing, like a little, something that wasn't going to have a major effect on this election, to something that might have a large effect on this election. I don't know, maybe you're the political scientist here, but... It's what do you make of the political messaging there, as well as the kind of form of that messaging, which is to say, you know, as McKenna was describing, the podcast candidate.
Yeah. So, I mean, two points I make there. I think, first of all, when we think about influencers and podcasts, you know, it's worth saying that the study of this stuff is really in its infancy. But when I think about it, the reason that, you know, insofar as it might be effective, that I think it might be particularly effective is less the idea that, okay, well, I really trust this makeup influencer to tell me who to vote for. And it's more about the audience, that one of the central challenges in political persuasion is the kind of people who consume...
Finding your people.
Well, it's just the kind of people who consume political news are not persuadable. And the kinds of people who don't know that much about politics are the people that you want to reach, and they're not consuming political shows. So if you go on CNN to do an interview, you're not going to reach that many persuadable people. There some, and I have some research with my colleague Josh Kell at Yale showing more than you might think, but still they skew more active. Whereas a makeup influencer, I think it's less the endorsement and more about just the access you get to somebody who has revealed through consuming makeup content that politics, you know, is not necessarily as important as their number one priority.
Or like the UFC would be another example.
Exactly.
Like that, the UFC
crossover. Yeah, sports, exactly. The other thing I'd point out, though, is that, you know, even with my previous answer in mind, that I think these effects tend to be small, it's just worth underscoring our recent elections have just been so close, right? And so, you know, you might say, okay, well, an effect of, you know, far less than one percentage point, it's so small. But, you know, when you think about something like RFK, where in American elections, you know, we have a two-party system, it's very, very hard for third-party candidates to win. But, of course, they can certainly play the role of spoilers. And I don't think we 100% know yet who exactly RFK Jr. is going to get, you know, steal more votes from, so to speak. But, you know, all it takes is a very small number to throw the outcome of the election one way or the other. So I think this absolutely might end up being an important part of the story of this election.
You know, Kyle, I'm curious, as you have been tracking what's happening, are there things that are surprising you about the way this election is playing out, or the types of ads that are being run on digital media?
Yeah, I mean, I think the definition, and David has definitely tracked this as well, that like the definition of what is a political ad has just completely transformed over the years. So particularly on the left, but also on the right, super PACs, a lot of people are just paying to promote mainstream news articles in voters' Facebook feeds. We call it boosted news, and it is like a common persuasion tactic online nowadays. There are a lot of undisclosed, when we talk about influencers, there's a lot of undisclosed sponsorship relationships with some of these influencers where we don't know if an influencer is being paid. I know the Biden campaign has integrated some sort of vertical video influencer, direct-to-camera videos into their ad program on Facebook and Instagram. And so, yeah, that definition of what is a political ad is just really changing and being expanded. And then just to double click on what David said, I mean, this election could be decided by like 10,000 people in just a handful of states. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about reaching beyond your own audiences, you know, doing content with like an Arizona hiking influencer is going to be really important because they probably reach millions of people that don't follow politics.
Yeah. Or even tens of thousands of people who don't follow politics.
Yeah, yeah, that too.
You know, one of the interesting things, and McKenna, I wonder if you've seen anything around this. When I was looking at 2020 digital ads, back when there was a little more visibility into how the Facebook ecosystem was working, most of, particularly the Donald Trump ads, were not about persuading anybody. They were purely direct response, like fundraising ads. Is that still where a lot of, you know, a lot of what the ads look like?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Back, piggybacking off of what Kyle said, in your newsletter a couple weeks ago, maybe a week ago or something, you were noting the Daily Scroll, which was a Facebook page that I guess was backed by the Biden campaign. That was this kind of boosted news situation. And so, you know, when I was going through, of course, when I read Kyle's newsletter, I click on it, I have to go through the Facebook ads database to see all this stuff. And like, yeah, I do think like the Biden campaign is doing more interesting stuff in that way. It's really funny that it seems like Trump's like fundraising has really stalled out. People are getting tired of being asked for money all the time, but I don't really think that's necessarily stopping them. But I do think something important to note, and like Kyle was mentioning before, is that when you are boosting sources that aren't directly tied to you, whether that's the New York Times or an influencer saying something really nice, I mean, like we said, it's very difficult for a politician themselves, for an ad themselves, to persuade someone. But I'm easily persuaded by my peers.
Right.
You know, if my peers tell me that this bar in the Lower East Side is really great, I'm going to go. I'm going to bring my friends next week, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of in the similar way, whereas I'm way more, you know, way more willing to go listen to those recommendations. And I think that's also what a lot of this advertising and influencer relationships work on.
Yeah. You know, I wonder, how are we going to measure, David, like whether any of these things have been effective? Like from your position, trying to like understand whether going on the Joe Rogan podcast changes yeah. anybody's minds. Like, how do you even approach trying to understand if that was effective?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in my field in political science and in social science more generally, the gold standard is similar to medicine, actually. We do randomized controlled trials. So just like if you think about the COVID vaccines and, you know, why are we so confident in that they're safe and effective? It's because we have taken a large group of people, randomly assigned them to two groups that would otherwise be the same. One of them we gave a placebo, one of them we gave the COVID shot, and then they tracked a bunch of, you know, outcomes, right? And so we do the same thing in politics. We'll randomly assign voters to different interventions. This can be social scientists. Campaigns do a lot of this. There's a great Sasha Essenberg book called The Victory Lab over 10 years ago now. And that, you know, that was considered, there was a lot of experimentation. Now there's even more. But it's basically the same approach. And, you know, getting back to what we were saying at the top of the show, you know, social media has presented a real challenge for social scientists, you know, just like for campaigns, because the platforms are kind of walled off and it's not as easy to do things like randomly assign people to different ads or whatever else. There have been some studies. So, for example, some Stanford economists a few years ago randomly assigned some subset of Facebook users to agree to deactivate their Facebooks for, I believe it was a month or a couple months, mm-hmm. And to say, okay, well, what would happen in a world where those people are not using Facebook? And I do think the results of that study, which I wasn't involved in, are pretty interesting and instructive for this. They find that knowledge about news goes down, and they also find that polarization goes down. Huh. And my interpretation of that, those results are, look, when people get on social media, just as we've been talking about, they get exposed to a bunch more news content, political content, and a lot of what that does is just teach them about what's happening in the world, and some of what's happening in the world they don't like. And so, you know, it's hard for me to look at results like that and, you know, some of the conversations about influencers or campaigns and have an all negative view. I mean, a lot of why this stuff persuades people is it's informing them about what's going on in the world, and mm-hmm. that might motivate them to vote. It might let them know there's someone I should vote for I didn't realize I should vote for. And so I guess one man's, you know, manipulation is another man's persuasion, I guess, or information.
Yeah. McKenna, what are you looking for going forward here? Like, spin us forward a little bit. Like, how are you devoting your time to kind of track in the next few months here?
Sure. So, I mean, a big thing to watch this election year is definitely going to be how AI is finding itself into this election. Mm-hmm. Of course, we saw in the New Hampshire primary the Biden robocall that was not Biden, discouraging people to vote. Mm. So that's definitely one thing. And that's also something, like we said, that isn't like, it's very difficult to predict where this is going to pop up, you know? And so I, you know, ear to the ground on that mm-hmm. so far. But also a big thing that I'm following and that I'm dedicating a lot of time on right now is how influencers who have gained access to political campaigns, to the White House, et cetera, how many more interviews are they getting than the press, right? Mm. How is this shaping the narratives that we have online about, you know, this election, voting, all kinds of things like that? Because a funny thing that happened to me at the Sim fundraiser that I mentioned earlier was that all these influencers went out to dinner with Biden campaign people before they came to this fundraiser, and then they sat in the fundraiser for the whole event, whereas the press was kept in the dressing room for about 4 hours before we were let out.
Oh, man.
So you're seeing a lot more relationships like that blossoming, right? Where these influencers can post these really cool videos of Lizzo dancing, and I'm just like kind of stuck in the dressing room. And I'm sure it sounds kind of jealous, but I do think
no, it's your job to get in there too, right? So that totally makes sense to me. That'd be very
and
frustrating.
So it's not, yeah, it's not jealousy, but it really is like, this is definitely a change that has like flipped since 2020. Mm. And I'm really curious to see where it all goes.
Yeah. We've been talking about elections, social media, political messaging. The show is put together by two members of KQED's Youth Advisory Board, Ryan Heshmati, a junior at Saratoga High School, and Kate Quach, a junior at St. Ignatius. We've been joined by McKenna Kelly, senior politics writer and author of Wired's Politics Lab newsletter. Thanks for joining us, McKenna.
Of course, this is really fun.
We've also been joined by Kyle Tharp. His newsletter is For What It's Worth, tracking digital strategy, spending, and trends in politics. Thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, it was a great discussion. Thanks.
And we've been joined by David Brockman, associate professor of political science at UC Berkeley. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
This is Youth Takeover Week. We're going to have some more great shows coming up, produced by Bay Area high school students. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.